Mindful Reflection combines mindfulness meditation and visualization with reflective thinking. In this workshop about preparing for the holidays, we look at four ways to change how we relate to ourselves and our family. Take a look at the wheel diagram that came with your download. First, from right to left, context. We look at the consequences of certainty or the need to be sure of ourselves, as opposed to a flexibility of heart and mind. Secondly, perspective. We learn to see what is rather than what we expect when we tend to shut out things we don't like. Thirdly, we look at our decisions, how they're triggered by an urge to hang on and how we can learn to let go. Finally, there's our conscious or more often our subconscious motivator, which runs the gamut from fear to courage. Mindful reflection brings clarity in these four areas, and with persistence, it can change the family dynamic. This recording is about context, from certainty to openness. Here's the workshop. Welcome back to this special mindful reflection workshop about family holidays. I sent out a request, I think you all got it, asking for questions or particular things that you'd like to hear spoken about or discussed. And I have the basis of a 12-week workshop. But we'll get it all done in 40 minutes, don't worry. When we're dealing with family, we often want them to be different. We want to be treated differently. And we can't make that happen. The way they perceive us is their problem. What we tend to overlook, or it's not that we overlook it so much as we don't really want to see it this way, is that the way we see them is our problem. And that's actually the problem that we can address. It's the only one that we can really address. And it has a lot to do with expectation, of course. Everything has a lot to do with expectation because everything is changing and we can't control it. And that includes people that we think we know like the back of our hand, including ourselves. We don't know each morning that we wake up how the day is going to turn out or how we're going to deal with it. And sometimes we deal with it rather well, and sometimes we just make a complete mess of it. And that's the way life is. However, a little planning and a little thought and a lot of mindfulness helps a great deal. And mindfulness is good for a lot of things. If you Google mindfulness, probably now you will find millions of pages. And you will literally find tens of thousands of scientific studies on mindfulness. Some of it is very questionable. Some of it is not very scientific at all. I have serious reservations about it. But nonetheless, some of it is, and it does seem quite encouraging, and mindfulness is good for stress, and it's good for heart disease, and it's good for all sorts of things. Not many scientists are investigating what it's bad for, but it actually is bad for some things. Serious mental disease, for example. It's not a good idea. It's not a good recipe. However, people don't really want to talk about that. They want to talk about how good it is. And people love to look at the upside of everything. Positive thinking is great. Except I have some problems with it. We'll talk about that. But the point of what I'm saying now is that mindfulness, although it's good for all sorts of things, really, if you go back to the roots of it in the Buddhist teachings, the core purpose of mindfulness is to get to the root of our own motivations. Why am I doing this? Why do I expect this of my brother or my sister or my father or myself? What am I looking for here? What do I want from this family? What is my role? How do I see my role? How does that make me act? Who defines my role? And these are not scientific questions which we can discover through objective inquiry. These are very subjective questions which we discover by watching our own mind. It doesn't matter what the objective truth is. It's completely, almost completely irrelevant. What really matters is how you perceive and what you expect. And so today, on our little chart here, our wheel, we're going to talk about context. Context goes from 11:30 to 4:30. And the span is from openness to certainty. And certainty is on the right in red, and certainty is a bad thing, believe it or not. Well, actually, there's nothing wrong with certainty if you can actually find any. The problem is our need for certainty. And the fact that we look for certainty where there is none, where there never will be any. And the motivation is that we cannot accept that things are uncertain. And it's hard. We want to know what's going on. That's why we become Buddhists or Scientologists or philosophers or atheists or whatever it is we think we need to become. Whatever set of beliefs or disbeliefs we engage in, we do because we're looking for some sort of explanation. We're trying to rationalize this life, but life is irrational. The fact that it's irrational doesn't mean that we can't rationalize it. We can. But we have to look at the relevance of that rationalization. It can help with some things. We can figure out why our family is treating us the way they are. That doesn't necessarily change the way that we respond, because we are emotional creatures and we act from the heart and we act more often from impulse, from old habit. So the purpose of mindfulness is to see why we are reacting or engaging or expecting in the way that we do. And that requires us to take a step back. And by taking a step back, we create the possibility of a new context. And that new context requires us to let go of certainty and basically say, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know the way things should be. I don't know what the ultimate purpose of life is. I don't know if there is one. That's not something that the human brain likes to deal with. So it's counterintuitive. We all think we've got things figured out or we're letting go or whatever, but nevertheless, we all have a common metabolism and a common mental structure which makes us seek meaning. And it's okay to seek it. The problem is expecting it. And if we can't find it, the problem is in creating it or inventing it, otherwise known as wishful thinking. And we know that religion is full of wishful thinking. Science also has a healthy dose of wishful thinking built into it, because scientists are people. They're not super beings, and they don't step out of the subjective world. They try to. And the scientific method is very rigorous and very useful and very powerful. But still, these people are just human beings like you and me. And they do things to look after themselves, to boost their ego, to make themselves feel more secure, to overcome their fears. So they have to get around that too. Science, good scientists are mindful. People who are good at anything are mindful. Mindfulness is not an invention of the Buddha or of Eastern religion. Mindfulness is a natural state of mind that can be reached through diligence, through energy, energetic practice, through determination and integrity. It belongs to the human race, but only a small portion of the human race actually pursues it, because it doesn't give immediate gratification. takes time. We're building a new context. So let's begin right now. Let's continue right now. Take a minute, make yourself comfortable with your back straight, shoulders relaxed. Take a breath and release it. And I want you to focus on the release of the breath. Watch it. Don't make it happen. Watch it happening. And also watch the in-breath, but see how it just sort of springs back. It's a natural reaction to letting the out-breath happen. Let the out-breath go. Watch your body come to a moment of stillness. And then see the breath coming in again. You can actually watch it as if you're looking at the sunset or looking at the trees waving in the wind. It's a feature of nature, something which is happening naturally. Let go of the out-breath. In every sense of the word, let go. Let it out. Let it happen by itself. And now take your awareness to include your whole body. Although much of it is relaxed, nevertheless you keep it erect, keeping a certain balance. It's not falling over, it's looking after itself. You don't need to manage or control it. Not consciously. Once upon a time, you had to learn that. You learned to stand and to walk. But now that intelligence is part of your body. You can let go. So here you sit, stable, erect, breathing regularly. Maintaining the body, the balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide. you exist, you persist. And as you feel the sense of stability and clarity and automation of a sort, allow yourself to take 3 more breaths and open your eyes. Now, closing your eyes and letting your body breathe seems to be an awfully easy thing to do. I mean, it's so simple, it's a no-brainer. But if you were to ask a biochemist what was going on, you might be astonished at all the processes which are being looked after by the body. And you might even remember, probably not, but you might remember having learned to walk and to stand. But you probably don't remember piecing your body together cell by cell when you were in your mother's womb. But that is what happens. That rudimentary intelligence is a part of who you are. It's a part of your genetic makeup. She doesn't have 2 little hands inside the womb there piecing you together. It's a part of you. So there's a lot going on. There's a great deal of intelligence going on, and it's happening quite naturally and quite effortlessly. I want you to imagine bringing that effortless intelligence to your family dinner. All you have to do is be there. And hey, it's a celebration. You're supposed to enjoy it. But we don't enjoy it because we have to make sure everybody feels good, that nobody feels bad, that we haven't done anything wrong, that we don't get into trouble, we don't say the wrong thing or trigger an argument, or we miss an opportunity to bring people together when they're actually busy hating each other. We have our place in the family, and that place may change depending on who's there and how things are going. Sometimes we make trouble. Sometimes we patch it up. Sometimes we just sit back very quietly and silently in our shell. And sitting silently is not mindfulness. Mindfulness is active, it's thoughtful, it's curious. It's intelligent, but it's not passive. On the other hand, neither is it interfering. We don't stick our nose in where it doesn't belong. And that's always the problem with family, isn't it? The problem is being good, making the right decision. So, here's something to think about. Why should you have to be good? Why should you have to be right? Why should you have to be anything? With your practice of mindfulness, this is not a rhetorical question, by the way. This is a very serious question. Why? So, first of all, the purpose of mindfulness is to see, well, I have to make sure everybody's okay. Okay, that's what you feel, that's what you see. That's point one. Point two, why? Why is this your role? Who gave you this role? Who is enforcing it? What's the motivation? Now, you can come up with all sorts of answers to that, but I'm going to give you the right answer in advance, because there is only one answer. And the answer is you. If you feel guilty, it's because you choose to. And I'm sorry if that sounds preposterous or rude, but it's true. We allow ourselves to feel guilty. We choose to put this stuff on ourselves because in some, twisted way, we feel obligated to feel guilty, to get things right, to be in charge of the situation. Because Lord knows the rest of the family is no good at it. You have to do it. Now, imagine a whole room full of people thinking that way, sitting down together. And there you have Christmas dinner at our house. Not the house I live in now. No, different. We talk. But this is the point. What can we do and what can we not do? Can you make everybody happy? No. Can you stop them from feeling guilty? Not if they want to be guilty. They will be. They want to be aggressive. They want to be obnoxious. Or they want to pretend that everything's fine and they love everybody. That's their choice and you can't do a thing about it. You can see through it. You can see that it's BS, that it's actually that pretense of love and joy is actually causing more problems than it's solving. But you can't change that. What you can change is the way you react to that. You can change your involvement with that. You can change your sense of feeling responsible for fixing that. Somebody has to fix it. You have to fix it because you're the youngest daughter or because you're the eldest son, or because you're the mother, or the father, or the sister, or the in-law. There's no difference. Somebody will put that trip on you, or you will think they do, and just the fact that you feel it is enough. It's a subjective state. It's up to you to know what you feel and why you feel it, and then once you know that, then you have an opportunity. You can choose to let go. Unfortunately, letting go is not just a one-act play. It's an ongoing process. You have to keep letting go. But in order to keep letting go, you have to keep seeing through the situation. So it takes practice. That's why families get themselves tied up in knots, is because most people are not willing to go through that work. They want solutions, and they come up with a rational decision on how things should be, and they try and enforce it. And whether it works or not, people tend to stick to their guns. They tend to be very consistent in their expectations of their family. My family always told me and reinforced it again and again that I was impatient and I had a bad temper. And they seemed to expect me to be otherwise. They seemed to expect me to turn into a saint. But at the same time, they kept reminding me how I wasn't that way. So I'm not quite sure what their expectation was. I think their real expectation was for me to continue being impatient and bad-tempered so that they had the certainty of knowing what sort of person I was. They had the certainty of knowing where their role in the family was. But they pretended to me, and I think they were pretending also to themselves, that they expected me to change. So this is completely irrational nonsense. It's ridiculous. They expect me to be one way and they expect me to be the opposite way at the same time. And this is the way the emotions drive us to think in paradoxes and in contradictions, especially about the other members of our family, especially about our siblings. Because it's all about attempted control. We're trying to control the situation, not because we're horrible, evil monsters, but because we're trying to make peace. But we're trying to do it in a way that will never, ever work. You cannot do it by reasoning your way through it. You do it by close observation, by watching carefully, by being mindful. And that requires a sort of honesty, which again is counterintuitive. We tend to see what we want to see. And we have to learn to get past that and say, wait a minute, what is really my motivation here? Why am I doing this? It's much more common than you might think for siblings to stop talking to each other for years, for the rest of their lives. I told you the story about my two uncles. Looks like they didn't speak to each other for about 30 years. When do you make that decision? Is that right? Can you do that? Is it allowed? Is it wrong? There's no answer to that. You see, if you stop talking to a sibling because you want peace, you're not going to get peace. But if you continue talking to the sibling because you want peace, you're also not going to get peace. I mean, you're screwed. This is not a joke. This is very serious. Life, I'm not saying this happens with all siblings. What I'm saying is that life is like this sometimes. Life does not necessarily give you what you want. And sometimes it most definitely gives you what you don't want. And there is nothing you can do about it except accept it. This is very important. It sounds trivial, sounds obvious. You have to accept what you can't change. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. And it requires mindfulness, and it requires that same process of letting go. You have to keep letting go, knowing that it might never come to an end. You'll never reach the point where you don't have to let go anymore. But one way or the other, you've got two choices, both of them unpleasant. But you might choose one knowing that it is more honest, that it shows more integrity, that it's more truthful. It's very difficult to stand back and do nothing. Especially when you see a family fighting, or even worse, if you see them triumphant over you. And you have to accept the fact that you're much smaller in their eyes. And so you speak up, or you try to speak up, and you get squashed again. So then what? What's the solution? The solution is to know that sometimes there is no solution. You can't fix everything. And trying to fix everything causes much more stress in the life of human beings than the things that they're trying to fix. If we could accept what we can't change in complete equanimity, then our suffering would be reduced 70%, maybe more. What really ties us up in knots is our attempts to fix things that cannot be fixed. But that's not what we do. We keep trying. The purpose of mindfulness is to see ourselves doing that trying and to ask ourselves, why am I doing this? What do I expect? And so the context which we're creating is one of openness, in which we're learning that we can't really seriously expect anything. And to the extent that we can let go of that expectation, and we can let go of our need for certainties, that somebody has to control this, and I will do it. And to accept the open reality that this is not really a controllable situation. You know, human beings have been talking about a world without war and hunger for centuries. And we talk about the incredible progress we've made in the last 300 years. But we're not any closer to a world without war and hunger. Not one step. Now, if you're a politician, you'll say that, well, that's a failure on behalf of the human race. We have failed. We have to succeed. Which is very brave. But it's unlikely to happen. Maybe we should take a closer look at the human makeup and see why these things are happening all the time. Why we can't fix them. Why we haven't fixed them. Maybe it is resolvable. But openness means maybe it isn't. And that's an awful thing to accept. It's an awful thing to invest in. Accept that it reduces the overall suffering that we experience. It stops us sticking our nose in when we can't actually change anything. It stops us making things worse. It enables us to accept the way things are. It teaches us to let go. It reduces stress. It gives us clarity. It enables compassion. It's a good thing. It just looks bad, but it's actually a good thing to be realistic. You know how teenagers fall in love, and sometimes we do it at an older age as well. We fall in love with somebody who doesn't love us, or somebody who did love us finds somebody else. And you just can't believe that it's over. You just can't believe it. It's like, it's not possible. It can't possibly be over because I've still got all these feelings. But it really is over. And it takes months sometimes to accept that. That's the human heart. Of course, we get better at it, hopefully, as we go older. We accept it. But it's not easier. It's never easy. And it's a funny thing, because falling in love is falling into a state of openness. And yet the next thing you know, it loads you up with all sorts of expectation, which is the opposite of openness. You need the certainty of that love. You need the certainty of that relationship. You need to be able to rely on it 100%. I'll love you forever. It sounds like a lovely thing to say, but it's an empty promise. You can't decide what you're going to love and who you're going to love and how long you're going to love. You think you have that control over yourself. You're wrong. No one does. Love is not a decision. So when you go to a family dinner and the expectation on you is to be loving and caring and to have no conflict and to be completely accepting and generous, you might not feel like it. And that's okay. But in order to accept it, it's okay, you have to let go of something. And ultimately, what you're letting go is your role, or more precisely, your role playing. You do not have to play the role that you think everybody expects of you. And that's very difficult. It's very difficult because in the family, more than anywhere else, everywhere we look, we see our role facing right back at us. It's almost like being in a prison or a suit. And the suit is being controlled by someone else who's got their hands on the levers. And we just find our arms and legs doing and our brain doing whatever everyone else expects of us. It's a very difficult situation to step back from. And that's why we practice mindfulness to develop that muscle, to develop the skill that enables us to just take that step back into that new context of openness, where we can accept the fact that everybody's trying to be in control and everybody thinks they're trying to fix it. And that I'm doing exactly the same thing, except that I'm not going to believe it anymore. I can see myself doing it, and okay, maybe I might slip up and I'll just react, but I'm not going to believe in it. As soon as I've done it and I see it, I'm going to let it go. And that's the practice. It's as simple as that. And it's as difficult as that. It's very hard to do, and it's very simple. Simple things are the hardest. This brain is not made for simplicity. It likes sophistication. It likes to think of how clever it is and how resourceful. So it resists simplicity. But a little bit of simplicity goes a long way. I was speaking with my sister a few weeks ago. Actually, a few months ago. She hasn't called me since. She'd been having a little trouble with a relative and had spoken to me about it. And so we had a chat, and she had a little cry, and she seemed to feel better about it. And then the next time I called her, I asked her how it was going. And she said, oh, it's fine, everything's fine now. And I said, oh, okay. And then I called her again a little later, and I asked her again how it was going. And she really didn't want to talk about it. And she is the peacemaker in our family. She's always trying to bring everyone together and be nice to everybody. But she couldn't find it in her heart to call me back because I'm pretty sure she was afraid of me probing that question, pressing on that wound again. And that's me. I'm trying to fix it. See, I do the same thing everyone else does. I'm trying to help her out. She doesn't want to be helped. She's got it all fixed. In fact, she's told me very clearly. I once said to her, you know what, Maria? You're in denial. And I was visiting with her, and she looked me in the eye and she said, yes. And she had me. I didn't know what to do. Of course, there's nothing you can do. It's not an unconscious decision for her. It's a very conscious decision. She's chosen that route. It works for her, she thinks. I don't think it does. I see her suffering. But that's the decision she's made, and I can't change that. I cannot. And it makes me sad, and it makes me feel impotent. But I have to accept it. And if I don't accept it, she's not going to call me. And actually, we get along pretty well, apart from that. We don't have any issues between us. We get along reasonably well. Our family is not too bad, actually, on the whole. Since we don't see much of each other, we're scattered across the globe. Although we certainly have our issues. So you pick and choose your battles. You pick and choose your issues. But you have to look at what's real. You cannot pretend that things will get better. It's very important to let go of certainty and be open. Allow yourself to believe that things might not get better. And funnily enough, if you can do that, you'll feel better. It's true. Funny, eh? It's the stress we put upon ourselves. I've got to. You know, I keep going back to this example because it's so hugely tragic. And yet it's so typical. And I think of the time that George Bush decided to invade Iraq. But I was paying a lot of attention to it, and the argument was always the same. Essentially, it came down to this. We can't do nothing. How can we do nothing? We have to do something. And the reality is that what they did had nothing to do, I mean, do something about what? About the attack on the World Trade Center. What they did had nothing to do with that. What they did not make anything better for anyone. But they had to do something. And this is very typical human behavior. When we feel weakened or slighted, or we're in a situation which is compromised, or we feel uncertain, or we feel that things are not the way they should be, we feel like we have to do something. And by trying to fix it, very often we make it worse. And this is purely reactive behavior. This is unmindful behavior. Of course, you might not agree with my political views, but I hope that doesn't get in the way of what I'm trying to say. I'm a great fan of the philosopher John Gray. He's an English philosopher. He wrote a book a few years ago called Straw Dogs, which was really extremely well written, very short, very to the point. And he explains how the whole idea of progress, especially in humanism and atheism, is basically derived from the Christian sense of salvation. That ultimately the human, and this goes back into many other religions, into many earlier times, basically there's this belief that underlies a lot of religion and a lot of non-religion as well, a lot of science, that the human race is just progressing. We're just getting better and better. But this is a complete fabrication. This is wishful thinking. There's absolutely no guarantee. There's no indication that we're going this way at all. We talk about progress, but 99.9% of the time when we say progress, what we actually mean is technological progress, not moral progress. Otherwise, we would have less famine and fewer wars. But that's not really happening. So progress is possible if we put our minds to it. It's not guaranteed by any stretch of the imagination. The only effective thing we can do is really look into our own motives and be honest about them. And say, why do I believe in this? Why do I believe that we are destined for greatness? Why do I believe that this person is the love of my life and I will never lose her? I will love her forever. I will transform my family into a perfect family. I will take on the role of the peacemaker and I will fix everything. Why are we doing this? In most cases, the answer will come down to the fact that I cannot bear to believe the opposite, that it's not possible. I cannot bear to believe that things might not just keep getting better, that my family might not become perfectly loving towards each other, that life might not have any particular purpose or meaning. It's very difficult to accept. But if we allow the possibility, then everything changes. Then our expectations begin to lose their grip. Our certainties begin to dissolve. And actually, even though that sounds terrifying, when we actually do it, the experience is liberating. We become unleashed. We acquire a flexibility that we only dreamed of. But you can't be flexible and certain at the same time. It's not possible. You know, universities, learning used to be all about exploring. In fact, that's why I went to university. I thought this is what I was going to learn, and I got a very rude shock. And if you talk to any students today about this, you'll find that they're very cynical about it. Because what they really have to learn more than anything else is how to pass exams. And the benefits of passing the exams are that they get a very high position in one very narrow direction where they end up generally getting stuck. So if they like it, that's great. But if they don't like it, they've sort of got themselves out on a limb. So there are problems with university education and formal education and credentials. And they're unavoidable, especially in the sciences, in medicine, in law. But we can't allow ourselves to be bound by that sort of training, because it's not education, it's training. Education is learning from experience. Not from books or from teachers. And the two are not incompatible, obviously. But you have to make room for the mindfulness, and that's where people have trouble these days. They're too busy doing the other stuff, making the money to pay the bills, to take the time to be mindful. And it's hard. I mean, I understand. I'm in the same boat as everybody. We seem to need more stuff, so we need more money to pay for this more stuff that we absolutely need. We can't possibly do without it. You know, when I was a kid, we used to talk about, oh, you know, the Jones up the road, they're a two-car family. They got two cars. It's like, wow, they're rich. Now it's normal. Well, yeah, it's normal. And what does that mean? It means that we have to make more money. And guess what? Both parents go out to work. What does that mean? Well, it means a lot of things. Kids see less of the parents. The kids are becoming so rude. They're not as polite as they used to be. Gee, I wonder why. Maybe they're not spending enough time with people who are teaching them. There's a price for everything that's going on. There's a reason for it all. But we're at a crisis because we need, and we're absolutely convinced that we need more stuff. And it's very hard to let go of that. And I've been letting go of it all my life, and I still find it hard. We could share one car. It's possible. We could save, my God, how much money could you save? But we don't. So we have to find our own balance, you know. We have to accept the fact that we're not all perfectly logical or perfectly spiritual or perfectly ethically balanced. We accept that. And do our best. Stop pretending to be someone other than we are. But at the core of all of this is the heart. The heart is always at the center of these wheels. And instead of the heart, sometimes, a lot of the time, what stands in the center is the story of who we think we are. It's all about who we should be, according to ourselves, according to others, according to our family, according to society, according to God, whatever your terms of reference are. The human condition is very much about the social condition of being human, let's say, that's the way Freud would put it, is very much about fitting in, obeying the rules. And a lot of the reason that we're so desperate in our family situations to fix everything is because we don't want to be excluded. We're afraid of being cast out. We're afraid of not being really a member of the family anymore. Not doing our share of the work. Not accepting responsibility. Being accused. And so we act out of fear. That is not acting out of heart. Heart is courageous. Fear is all about trying to fit into a mold, which is not natural. And which, yes, we do to a certain extent have to fit into. We have to obey the laws of society. We have to obey the rules of social engagement to a certain extent. But to what extent? When do we start compromising ourselves? You're not going to find that in any rule book. It's something we have to figure out for ourselves. And the fact is that sometimes we do compromise ourselves and sometimes we go too far. But if we have a practice that can enable us at least to see that, even if we see it after it's already happened, then we have opportunities that otherwise are closed to us. And that is why mindfulness is so powerful. It's so useful. But even mindfulness can be abused. You could use it to find ways that you fit in even better. That everybody thinks of you exactly what you want them to think. That's an abuse of mindfulness. This is not going to bring you peace or clarity. It's going to complicate your life even more. Mindfulness involves integrity, honesty, compassion, empathy, insight. Insight is seeing things from the inside. You go right into your heart, and that's your context from which you look out. And in that context, you endeavor to be open, to let go of your need for certainty, to let go of your need for things to be a certain way, to let go of your need to understand sometimes. Some things are not understandable. Let's take a minute. Use your breath to bring your attention deep inside. Find a very stable foundation, a starting point for your observation. If your watchfulness. Watchfulness is another translation for sati, mindfulness. Watchfulness, recollection. And from that foundation deep inside, you look out at your life. You look out at yourself, at your behavior, at your motivation. And the question is always the same. What is this? And the ultimate goal is to be honest. Stay with the breath. Find that foundation in your heart, in the very core of your being. And realize that the foundation itself rests on absolutely nothing. You are ultimately free. You can choose to obey or not, to follow custom or not, to adopt your role or not, to take responsibility or not. To be good or not. You really are free. The question is, why do you choose what you choose? Is it because you need things to be a certain way? Or because you're expressing your freedom? Do you want to be sure of what's happening? Let go. Do you need to be right? Let it go. You need to be clear. Let it go. Let go of your needs and instead be open, be curious, accepting, but also intelligent, discriminating, thoughtful, and kind. And take 3 more breaths and open your eyes. people think of meditation usually as being a state of great concentration or a visualization of some sort. And that is one form of meditation, but I was one of the very first things that I was taught by my Buddhist teachers was that actually there are two types of meditation. One is concentrative and the other is reflective or contemplative. So that we're not just focusing our attention, but we're also cultivating our thoughts. So we're thinking about things. That's why I call this mindful reflection. What we just did was a reflection, a reflective exercise in which we think about the way we are and how that's working for us and what we can do to let go of that and to create some freedom. We're not looking to find solutions. We're looking to create freedom, to explore rather than build. Cultivating in the way that we would cultivate a garden, not knowing exactly what's going to grow, which seeds will sprout and which ones won't, which will give more fruit and which won't. We just water it all and look after it all and see what happens. Eastern philosophies are often accused, or they were for a long time accused of being very passive. But this is not just passivity. It's also engaging with great intelligence. We're really using every part of our mind. The point is to explore our life with full balance, using every quality that we have. Concentration, yes, but also thought. Meditation is not an end to thinking. On the contrary, it provides a counterpoint. So yes, it's great to slow the thoughts and to create more mental space, but out of that space comes great clarity in which we find ourselves thinking better than ever. And the basic balance is one of two wings, the wings of empathy and insight. So that we understand and we put ourselves in the shoes of other people by understanding ourselves through our own insight into our own behavior and then looking at others and seeing how they deal with the same situations, seeing how they feel and finding an echo of that in our own feelings and our own experience, we come to greater understanding of the way things are. So that compassion is not some sort of condescending act towards somebody who's not as well off as we are, but it's an act of complete identification and understanding. And in fact, there is no difference between insight and empathy. The two work hand in hand. In fact, they're known as the two wings, and you can't fly with one wing. So this is the balance we're looking for. Balance, not solutions. The paradox of solution is that you have to have a problem. So that if you're looking for solutions in your life, it means that you're defining life as a problem. And maybe it isn't. Maybe life is not a problem. Maybe aging, sickness, and death is not a problem. It's an intriguing thought. So, when you find yourself looking at it as a problem, you know what to do. You ask, why do I think that? What is your motivation? What do you want? When I wake up in the morning and my bones are aching and I realize what is upsetting me is that I'm not 25 anymore and I can't turn the clock back. But why is that a problem? It's absurd. It's never happened. It's never going to happen. Why am I spending my time thinking about that and torturing myself with it? Why? Good question, eh? We do it. We all do it. It's amazing. Why? There's not one answer. There's a whole string of them. But they lead back to a state of freedom. And I heartily encourage you to follow that train of thought. It's very worthwhile. It unties us. Let's take another minute and just calm ourselves before we go out there into that awful world. Take a breath into your center and take that as your context. From here, you look out. And take three more breaths, open your eyes, and relax.
That's all from this Naked Monk workshop on family holidays. Thanks for listening. For more information, please visit thenakedmonk.com.